Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Marking Out with Mike. I want to thank everybody who's been listening, everybody who's been supporting. I don't know if you guys have been sharing it or listening to it twice or doing what you're doing, but the podcast is already up over 500 streams. When I checked it out today, right before I hit play and started recording this segment, it was at, I believe, 502 streams. So I'm very, very excited. I anticipated that this would take a little while to get going and get moving, but it's moved along a lot faster than I could have ever anticipated. We've got a steady group of people that do listen, and then a lot of people who just kind of poke in from time to time and check it out when they can. So whatever platform you listen on, I do encourage you to subscribe. Because the days that we release the episodes are fairly random. If there was a wrestling event the night before, chances are we will have a next episode out within about 48 hours. Generally, I'll have an episode the very next day. For example, following Monday Night Raw, we will have the episode on Tuesday. SmackDown, we would have it on that Saturday. But with AEW and NXT both airing on the exact same day, it does take me a while to get through it and watch it because that is a combined 4 total hours of wrestling. And each podcast, as you guys know or may not know, is an hour long. So right there, that's 6 hours of time. So it does take me a bit of time to get my notes together, do my research, gather up the news and notes and everything that goes into creating an episode. So generally, the episodes from Wednesday night won't be posted until probably Friday, like today. So I do want to thank you guys for listening, but I would heavily encourage you, if you give a damn, to subscribe on Apple, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, on Overcast, wherever it is that you listen. I'm not aware of a single platform, with the exception of one that we are not on. Anchor is my podcasting partner. You can go right online to anchor.fm and you can search for the show there and listen there if you don't subscribe to a select podcasting source. But there's a lot of different options, a lot of different opportunities on where you can listen and how you can listen. And I do want to thank every single one of you for listening, because otherwise, if you weren't listening, I might have to go to a psych ward because I would literally be walking around for an hour multiple times throughout the week talking to myself. So I want to thank every single one of you who's listened and who will hopefully continue to listen. But with that, we're going to start the show off. So if you're a first-time listener, the way we do things here on Marking Out with Mike is I start the first half hour, a little bit of story time like I just did, and then we get into the news and notes. News and notes are confirmed stories that I found around the web concerning things that are going on in the wrestling world. Injury reports, new additions that have been signed to contracts, extensions, just whatever is out there. It does take me a while to get these episodes up because I like to make sure that the news that I post is vetted. You may have seen on social media today, Kairi Sane actually called out Ringside News, who I've never been really big fan of because they seem to always post very clickbaity kind of stuff, which I'm not a fan of. They don't seem to have validity to a lot of their stories. A lot of their stories have been disproven. So I don't know if it's like a fan thing and they're just doing fan fiction and blogs and things like that. I don't know if it's just inept journalism or what it is, but they wrote a whole article based on a rumor they heard, I believe via Twitter, where Kairi Sane was describing her relationship with the WWE and her time living in the United States while performing for the WWE. And it's assumed, and she called them out for it, that they used Google Translate. And Google Translate, if you've ever used it, if you've ever talked to someone who speaks Spanish or a different language, they might tell you like, oh, you know, a little bit's lost in translation. That's not the correct translation. So there was something that she had said that simply made the word unhappy, or excuse me, the word happy appear as unhappy. So according to her, and I mean, the story's about her, so you don't get a much better source than that. She described her time in WWE as being happy. And I've never been in the business. I have no idea. I can't speak to what the typical WWE contract or history is like. We've all heard things, but you figure probably she came over to the United States, possibly got to see a bunch of places she had never been, traveled, because this was mostly before the lockdown, so she got to visit all these cities. She was good friends with Asuka, so, you know, she had someone native that she could hang out with. I don't know what her relationship with Shinsuke Nakamura is, but she had a few people in the locker room who spoke the same language as her that she was potentially able to confide in, and she had a good run in WWE for the short amount of time she was around. I believe she was NXT Women's Champion. Her and Asuka, of course, were the Women's Tag Team Champions for a while. And I'm sure she made a good amount of money. I'm sure you don't get featured the way she was and sign a small paycheck. So the idea that she would have been unhappy is kind of silly. It doesn't matter what you do for a living. Every job's going to have some things that are great and not so great. So I just thought that was funny that she called them out, and everybody kind of shared the same sentiment as me, which was, you know, you guys need to get your stories right and make sure you aren't sharing a bunch of bullshit. So with that said, I like to make sure that I myself am not posting a bunch of bullshit. So I will get things wrong. I will definitely get things wrong, but I will never consciously go out and share something that is incorrect just to get listeners, just to try to get streams, things like that. So if you ever do see something I mess up on, let me know, because I do go, I've already made a mistake. This is only our seventh episode, but I have made a mistake in the first six episodes. And the next episode that I record, I will go in and rescind or apologize and correct whatever that mistake was. So definitely, if you guys catch me on anything, you can be nice, but you can call me out and tell me what. So I think a lot of my success has come from my relationship with other wrestling fans on social media. I'm a part of a really great AEW figures collection group that focuses specifically on the AEW line. And I wanted to start the show off, at least this portion here, 7 minutes into the show, talking about AEW figures and just kind of figures in general. So that way my friends and people that I've met through social media that are here to support me can get that news. And then if you guys like, you know, I would prefer, hopefully you enjoy the whole episode and listen to the whole episode. But if you don't got the time, if you got to move on because you got kids and other things going on, maybe pause it and come back, or just tap out right there. But I am going to get that news out of the way for you guys, so I'm not holding you up throughout the entire episode. So today on Twitter, and today being Friday, October 9th, I don't know when you're getting to listen, but that's what I mean by today. So there were updated photos released of both the MJF and the Dustin Rhodes action figures as part of the AEW Unrivaled line. They're going to be coming out later this month, of course, as part of Series 2. So the MJF figure, MJF is going to have both his standard figure that will be available for about $20 at Walmart, and then he's also going to have a Chase variant. So that'll be like an alternative figure for those that don't know what a Chase variant is. It's usually limited to runs of about 500 to 1,000. I'm not 100% sure what this one will be. I think it's 500, but do not quote me on that. So his standard figure that's going to be in the Walmart line is going to feature him with his classic red trunks, and then also his Burberry style scarf that he famously wears. It's a really good looking figure based on the photos. He has that smug expression because he's the heel, you know, he's the salt of the earth, the guy that we all love to hate. And then his Chase variant is going to have pink tights. It appears no scarf, and then he's going to have the Dynamite diamond ring, which is really cool. I don't normally invest in Chase figures, and I doubt I will for this one, but it would be really sick to get one that also comes with the ring. So I just recently saw that Ringside Collectibles released a limited run of some of the Jericho variants, and they sold out in about 2.5 minutes. So I imagine as the time comes in a few months from now, probably a few weeks from now, the MJF figure will probably pop up there as well. The second figure was the Dustin Rhodes figure with the half face paint like he's been doing since he joined AEW. So one side will be red, of course. Hopefully they eventually release a blue one. I've been a really big fan of that getup. So those are both Justin Padaware. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his name right. He's the gentleman. He's like the president over there at I think Wicked Cool Toys, and he's working with Jazzwares, and they're making it all happen. So they're on his page. They're also on each of the respective wrestlers' pages, and the Ringside Collectibles account also has those all on Twitter. So if you're on Twitter, you know, you can check those out. And while you're on Twitter, if you so like, you can follow me on Twitter. My username there is Mike S. Flanagan, and I would appreciate any new followers, anybody who likes the show. Thank you very much. In other figure-related news, not AEW, but Ringside Collectibles has the new Series 113 in stock. You may or may not have already seen this. This is going to be the WrestleMania version of both Andre the Giant and Macho Man Randy Savage. And they're going to come with those ring carts that they famously came out to the ring on. So those look really cool. I already have quite a few Macho Man and Andre figures. So I don't know that I'm going to rush out and get those. But those ring carts do look really cool, so I don't know if they'll eventually have that available as a Lucy that I can buy off of another collector, or possibly just Ringside might release them as a standing thing by themselves. They do sell a few accessories like the steel steps and stretchers and caskets, so that'd be cool. I would definitely buy one or two of those by themselves if one was ever released. Also, kind of rounding out the figure-related news, Survivor Series 2020 figures have been released, and that's featuring wrestlers like Kane, Samoa Joe, Drew McIntyre, and John Morrison. Morrison was a top 10 seller on Ringside. Ringside Collectibles has definitely gotten me back into figure collecting, so I thought I would go down as of today and read what their best-selling top 10 figures are. So if you've been out of the game like I was for a while, or you just have fallen behind for whatever reason, the top 10 figures currently on their website is the Elite 82 Keith Lee, the Elite 82 Jerry Lawler, which is like a very classic Jerry Lawler. So that one looks cool. I do have a King, but I would possibly get that one. The Firefly Funhouse Bray Wyatt, the one that comes with the puppets. It's a Ringside exclusive Elite action figure. I do have that, as well as the Ultimate Edition of The Fiend on order. I'm hoping to get those. I believe they're going to arrive in November sometime. John Morrison, that we just mentioned, part of that line, is number four. And then the complete set of four, the WrestleMania 37, which features China, that comes with the WWF Women's Championship. And then rounding out the bottom five is going to be Alexa Bliss, China herself, Rey Mysterio, Shawn Michaels, and Goldberg. So a lot of great figures there. And check them out. You know, get back into the action if you've ever fallen out for any reason. So other kind of news and notes that I have, that's the last of the figure news. So if you do got something else that you need to go do, definitely go ahead and scamper away if you need to. But there were some rumors about the draft. I'm just going to leave those alone, because by the time you get to listen to this, you've probably already been able to watch SmackDown. We won't really address draft rumors on this. We'll just kind of jump into what actually happens on the draft when I get around to posting the podcast on Saturday that will feature the SmackDown review. For those of you who keep up with Ring of Honor, they just finished round one of the Pure Tournament, and I just have the quick and easy versions of the round one results for you. So in no particular order, in round one, Jay Lethal defeated Dalton Castle with a handspring cutter. So did the Tajiri-style move where he goes on his hands and bounces backwards off the ropes, hit him into a beautiful-looking cutter, and was able to secure the victory there. Jonathan Gresham was able to defeat Wheeler Yuta. He had an interesting, I guess it was a submission. So he got him in position like he was going to do a ankle lock, but then he didn't do the ankle lock, and he just did this repeated knee smash. I don't know if that's a signature move of his. I try to keep up with Ring of Honor, but I am guilty of not keeping up with it as much as I would like to. Maybe I'll see if I can subscribe to Honor Club to keep up with it a little bit more. But it was neat. He just like repeatedly slammed the guy's knee, which I could see if you're battered from the match would possibly hurt. And the guy like tapped out to that. I think it would look a little more convincing if there was maybe in addition to the knee strikes, if there was some sort of actual submission applied, like an ankle lock or maybe some sort of a camel clutch or something like that. It looked a little weird, but it worked. David Finlay defeated Rocky Romero. Matt Sydal, who's been getting featured on AEW recently, was able to defeat Delirious. He actually used Delirious's own move against him on the ground and got him in a Cobra Clutch, which earned him the submission. And Fred Yehi was able to upset Silas Young. Josh Woods was able to knock off Kenny King. So they went to a 15-minute time limit. So it wasn't a draw because there had to be a winner to continue in the tournament. So it went to a judge's decision. And Josh Woods was ultimately crowned the winner by the judges. And according to commentary, the decision was said to be close and right down the line. And I guess it came down to Kenny King not getting the edge because he had used a closed fist earlier in the match. So if you've been following wrestling for a while, you know that they claim that the closed fist is illegal. And so that's what ended up costing him. Russ Taylor defeated Tracy Williams via submission. So he actually dropped him with a pile driver, and then instead of pinning him, hit him in like this crossface looking submission, which caused him to tap out. And then in the last match, PJ Black was able to beat Tony Dippin via pinfall. So one interesting rule, I don't know, this was my first pure tournament, so I don't know if this is something they've done in the past or if this was new, but what they did is they added an element. So it was kind of cool because they tweaked the rules without like really changing the classic wrestling rules. I'm kind of an old school wrestling purist. I like things to stay the same, but I am receptive to innovations and things like that as well. But basically what they did is they added an element where during the match, if you found yourself in a submission, you got 3 rope breaks per match. So it was different. I had never seen that. I don't know if that's a Ring of Honor original thing that only they do, or if that's something that they adapted from elsewhere. But I thought it was really cool. You've heard me in the past, if you've listened to this podcast, kind of talk about things in wrestling that I like when they mirror classic and traditional sports. And one thing that was really kind of cool and neat about this, in my opinion, is it reminds me of in traditional sports like football and basketball, etc., where you have a number of timeouts and then you have to use those timeouts to kind of control the atmosphere of the game and keep control and slow momentum, try to ice a player. So it kind of made me think of that. They did do one spot where one guy had used all of his submissions, all of his rope breaks, I should say. But I could see that being really unique and creative in a position where potentially someone is caught in the center of the ring in a submission, and they have to crawl out under the ropes to avoid tapping because even if they were actually to get the rope break, it would do them no good. So as I continue to pay attention and consume more and more of the Ring of Honor wrestling, I hope to maybe see some variations of that. There's a ton of wrestling. I was so excited to start this show and I'm still excited to be here, but it was I thought at first, I was like, oh, there's tons of wrestling. And I knew I was gonna have to cover all 3 of WWE shows, plus their pay-per-views, plus of course AEW each week on Wednesdays, in addition to their, I think they do about 4 pay-per-views a year. So I really was like, let me throw Impact into the mix and maybe turn fans that are kinda anti-Impact into possible Impact Wrestling fans, or at least get people to pay attention to wrestlers that they might not have normally heard about. Because we all know it, the casual wrestling fan typically only watches WWE, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's where I started. I started on WWF back in the 90s and kind of grew into more as things were available. Didn't really watch WCW back in the day because I was a super mark and I just thought you had to be WWF or die. And by the time I got old enough to really appreciate the fact that there was other wrestling in the world, it was kind of too late, and WCW, ECW had all fallen off the map. So now I'm really relishing this second opportunity, especially because in wrestling, you might become a fan of a guy and he might be from AEW and things work out, and then shit happens and that wrestler might not normally be on that show anymore. They might fall off, whether it's due to some sort of miscommunication or fight that they had with management that got them fired, or just whatever, they want to go pursue opportunities elsewhere. So it's nice because that wrestler that you fell in love with that was on one product could then pop up, and I like it. I like it a lot. So if you are a newer fan to wrestling, whether you're old or young, whatever your story is, I encourage you, even if you can't fully divulge in all of it, I have to do the math one of these days and figure out. You figure Raw alone is 3 hours. Pay-per-views are typically about 3 hours, if not longer. And then each of these weekly shows is generally 2 hours, like Impact and AEW and these other guys. So when you really think about in a given week how much you've consumed, and this is before you even go over and look at the action for Major League Wrestling, New Japan, all these other promotions, there's a lot of wrestling to consume. And so it's my hope that maybe, because I do try to keep it real, I try to keep it grounded on this podcast, and I never try to be like a hipster or an elitist, like I've said so many times. I always just try to keep it simple. A fan making a podcast by a fan for other fans. And if at any point along the lines I can get a casual fan who's like, hey, you know, normally I don't watch Impact, but this guy on his podcast keeps talking about this wrestler that's doing something, and that's grabbed my attention, and I want to check it out. So that's my hope with this podcast, is that I can turn people on to new products and new things. And then as the world opens up, I want to try to maybe do some remote podcasting, broadcast live possibly at people's shows, mostly on the West Coast, of course, because that's where I'm based. But I think it's really cool. I think there's a lot of opportunities. Like so many of you guys, I'm super eager for all this COVID stuff to be over with, so that way I can get back into, you know, consuming wrestling even more and just checking it out. So we do have a few other news and notes that I want to get into as we approach the 30-minute mark, and then I will go into the whole AEW recap, possibly what you came here for. So I'll cover this more when I cover NXT in the next episode, but it was revealed a few days ago, following the match at TakeOver 31, Finn Balor had posted on Twitter that his jaw was broken in two places. So we speculated in the past whether that was a work, whether that was legitimate, because there were other quote-unquote injuries between guys like Velveteen Dream and others, Adam Cole's injuries. And of course, those were works, of course. Those were kayfabe. Those were to advance the story. But apparently, Finn Balor's jaw is broken in two places. In that next one, I'll talk about like the bad luck that he's had when he won the Universal title, and now what's happening here, and the possible title curse that some fans are calling it, especially given the recent history. But we'll talk about that on another one. And then this one is a big one. We all kind of knew it was coming, regarding Alberto Del Rio, and his continued battles and legal trouble. So earlier this year, back around the spring, he got himself in quite a bit of trouble with, an ex-girlfriend. And so here's kind of an update on that story. And, I got this online from PW Insider, so full credit to them. And I just kind of want to read it verbatim so that way I don't butcher anything. So it says, and I quote, "Former WWE and Impact Wrestling champion Alberto Del Rio was indicted yesterday by a grand jury in San Antonio, Texas, for aggravated kidnapping. Del Rio was arrested in May and charged with sexual assault, a second-degree felony, as well as aggravated kidnapping. Court records list the primary charge as aggravated kidnapping, so clarification is needed as to whether the sexual assault charge resulted in an indictment as well. The trial date has not yet been set. Del Rio is slated to be officially arraigned today. arraigned today, according to his court records. He had been out on a $50,000 bail. Del Rio, whose real name is Jose Alberto Rodriguez, age 43, was arrested on May 9th after a victim went to local authorities stating that on Sunday, May the 3rd, at 10 p.m., he had allegedly became angry with her and physically assaulted her after accusing her of infidelity. When the victim could not admit to the infidelity, Del Rio allegedly slapped her across the head several times. The victim also says that Del Rio forced her to wear a dress and dance for him, and that was when she refused, and he told her not to start crying because if she did, he would take her son and drop him off in the middle of the road somewhere. The arrest affidavit stated that the woman alleged Del Rio had sexually assaulted her and that she had her injuries documented via photographs. At the time, the Fox affiliate in San Antonio reported, police said that Del Rio then tied the woman's hands with boxing straps, put a sock in her mouth, and sexually assaulted her for several hours. Using various objects, according to investigators, he also punched her in the back during the sexual assault, causing visible injuries. The victim told detectives she did not remember much after he had placed his hand around her throat. And it goes on from there, guys. It's obviously very, very serious. And I understand that if your spouse cheats on you or your girlfriend or your boyfriend, that that's nerve-wracking. I've been cheated on before, but there is absolutely no justification for what he did. And the guy has a laundry list of problems. He had all his problems when he was involved with Paige, and they were kind of popping up randomly on Impact Wrestling. Never quite to this degree and to this severity and this craziness, but the guy is literally a loose cannon. He has a long, long list of problems, and it's pretty damn scary to think about the fact that he was in so many positions to be around women throughout his wrestling career. So hopefully he'll get his. Obviously, the guy, I would imagine, is got to be completely blackballed from every facet of wrestling, whether it's, the big times or even your small indie promotions. Because I'll say it, if you're an indie promoter and you get the opportunity to work with Del Rio in the future in any capacity, whether it's some ring action or a meet and greet or an autograph or whatever, you're a complete piece of shit if you sign that guy, if you pay him a dollar, if you work with him or promote him in any capacity. And the same could be said for fans. If you go and you get his autograph or you take a picture, I mean, if you did something in the past, like when he was with WWE and perhaps you didn't know, that's whatever. You know, I'm not one to sit here and pass judgment, but these are crazy things. It's what's that saying? Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice. Or no, fool me once, shame on you. I don't know what the saying is, but you know what I'm trying to say. Like, if you didn't know beforehand, then that's fine. But now that we know what we know, and we've heard it so many times from so many different places, there is absolutely no reason to have any of this guy's stuff. I thankfully don't have any of his merchandise. I don't have any t-shirts or any, I don't have any Del Rio action figures. And it's going to stay that way. So I'm not telling you to go burn all your jerseys like fans did with LeBron, but it's definitely the guy's a giant piece of shit, and no fans should relish him or support him or anything going forward in the future. So, but we got that out of the way, so we can kind of move on to some other happier news. Well, not happier, but less crazy than that. So WrestlingNews.co had reported some activity among the Retribution members on Twitter that kind of indicated it looked like Mercedes Martinez was no longer going to be part of the group. And that's basically been unofficially confirmed by WWE because Martinez had her profile quietly moved back to NXT on the company's website. And Mufasa Ali then put out another photo on Twitter, and that did not include her. So that gets us almost perfectly to the half an hour mark, and I'm going to jump into the AEW recap for today's show, so that way we can get this out and all the action can be there for you guys. So for The show opens up, AEW that is, and it goes without saying, guys, this is going to include a lot of spoilers. I meant to say this at the beginning of the show. I'm always really bad about that. But these podcasts are going to have spoilers, whether it's rumors or what ifs or scenarios. There are going to be scenarios in there. I'm going to post spoilers. I'm not trying to spoil it. I do share most of this stuff after the shows air. So hopefully that does avoid spoilers. But, you know, stop now. If I already spoiled something, I do insanely apologize. But going forward, everything is going to be talking about AEW from last Wednesday night. It's not going to be any fan fiction or any guesswork. It's going to all be cold hard spoilers. So turn it off now and come back if you haven't seen the show. All right. For the rest of us that are still here, the show opens up and there's a video package. It's just highlighting Chris Jericho's 30 years in the business. Really good videos. We would see that kind of throughout the night. A bunch of good stuff. So Santana and Ortiz mention Chris Jericho. They credit him with being the reason that they got into the wrestling business after reading his first book. He does, of course, have a second book coming out soon that you can pre-order. They mentioned it on the show. They didn't cut to Jungle Boy. He recalls his match with Chris Jericho for the AEW title earlier in the year, the one that went to the 10-minute time limit. So that was a big moment in Jungle Boy's career that he remembers. Sammy Guevara, kind of seeming like he's staying in character, mentions that his favorite moment was the famous Lee Sex Gods hug that the two of them did. Darby Allin mentions the pep rally. He talks about when Chris Jericho first appeared there, and he said that it helped jumpstart everything in AEW and also just let wrestlers know that they had options. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. It used to seem like it was WWE or bust. Even if you necessarily didn't like their politics, you had to go with WWE because they were the big dog in the fight and they were the ones that were going to get you the big paychecks, the exposure, and you just kind of had to swallow it. Now, you know, that might still be the case, but there's a few more dogs in the fight. AEW can compete with WWE in terms of finances, and it's really able to get guys exposure. And one of the great things that AEW does is on AEW Dark, they feature people on short-term, maybe one-off appearances, and they get appearances. There's a wrestler named Joe Alonso that I now know about that isn't exactly a big, crazy talent, at least yet. But he's on my radar because he was exposed on AEW and on AEW Dark and featured in some segments. And so it's just a nice time for wrestlers because they finally have so many different options from indies to all the bigger names around the world. Unrelated, that kind of ended that segment. The next match was coming up. But just a random note that I was kind of thinking about after watching Impact this past Tuesday and then watching AEW, I kind of really, really like that AEW and Impact, they have the ring announcers announce the matches as return matches. So if it's a rematch, instead of just saying it's a rematch and kind of brushing over it, usually a ring announcer would not talk about something like that. And as someone who I myself am an inspiring ring announcer, I've done some work in Tennessee and some smaller federations. I do like the idea of the following match is scheduled to be a return match, scheduled for one fall. I butchered that, but I promise I'm good at stuff when I practice. But I like that. It gives it kind of a big fight feel, and I thought that was really cool because I don't see any of the other companies besides those two doing that. So the show does open up. It's Will Hobbs and Brian Cage starting things off for the FTW title. Taz is on commentary, and he actually gives a very, very quick oral history of the FTW title because it came out over 20 years ago, so some of the newer fans might be pretty young and might not know the history of it. And so that was kind of cool. He says that it is not recognized by any promotion and kind of references, doesn't say ECW by name, but mentions that they didn't recognize it and that AEW doesn't recognize it. Which I still think is kind of weird that a not real, quote unquote, not real title is given TV time. I know I'm being super nitpicky about that, and I know that I'm probably the only one on the planet that actually does care about that, but it is something that I think about. But it was a good match. So a story was told during the match about Will Hobbs and his brother. They apparently had a history where Will Hobbs wanted to grow up and become a professional wrestler, and his older brother wanted to kind of go along for the ride and help manage him. Well, unfortunately, some of you may already know this, his brother died. And obviously, that's really sad. So everything Will Hobbs does in wrestling is kind of in honor for his brother, and I really like that. I have a brother that I'm close with, and I kind of think about, like, well, what would happen if something happened to my brother? That would be completely devastating. So, yeah, it was just something that I think of, and I thought that was cool. So Will Hobbs does need some work, but he's a really good worker. He's got the size and the look and everything. And so I hope good things for him, whether it's with AEW or elsewhere. I believe he was recently signed, so I mean, he's going to be there for a while. But it's hard to not hear such an emotional charged story like that and really kind of root for a guy. So Brian Cage does go on to retain the championship. At one point he hit his F5. I don't know if he calls it something else. And Will Hobbs was able to kick out, but he does finish him off with the drill claw to retain the title. So after the match, Taz gets on the mic and he gives Will Hobbs a ultimatum. His ultimatum is simple: join Team Taz or take an ass whooping. So before he has a chance and he's forced to answer that question, Darby Allin then comes out with his skateboard, and he doesn't really storm the ring or anything. He just kind of comes out. Team Taz decides to think better of the situation and they leave the ring. Taz does berate Darby, says basically that eventually he's going to get his, and calls him a punk. So obviously that's going to continue. Him and Ricky Starks is going to continue. It is funny though, because obviously you think about if it's the real world, if Taz had such a problem with Darby Allin, you'd think that he'd just send Brian Cage in there to squash him like a little bug. But I do like the storytelling. I do like that rivalry. I like the match that he and Ricky Starks had not too long ago, I believe a week ago, on AEW. So then they cut. It goes to some video segments before the commercial break. And it's people congratulating Chris Jericho on his legendary career. This is just something that we would see throughout the evening, throughout the show. So the first segment was legendary rocker Slash. He said his piece. And then, surprisingly, New Japan Pro Wrestler's very own Tanahashi got on there. And he was congratulating him. And then Chris Jericho's father, which if you don't know, he's an NHL player. I believe he's in the Hall of Fame. And that's one of the only on-screen times, I'm not saying it is, but that was the first time I'd ever seen any connection with the fact that his dad was, you know, a legend in his own right. So that was pretty cool. He says a nice thing, basically tells him to keep fighting, and then takes a sip of the bubbly, which was really kind of cool to see it tie all in together like that. So after that, oh, and then Bully Ray sent out a message as well, and he was chugging some of the bubbly as well, which I don't know how anybody chugs champagne with all the bubbles in it. So after the commercial break, we come back, and there's a tag team title match. So Hybrid 2 is in the match, and they're facing, of course, FTR for the AEW Tag Team Championships. Going into this match, I wasn't really the greatest Hybrid 2 fan. I'd only seen them on Dark and just was like, meh. I also was like, how the heck did these guys get a title match? But AEW did a pretty good job about explaining that away. So Excalibur explained on the commentary team that they got that opportunity because Hybrid 2 had won a series of matches on AEW Dark, and that kind of bumped them up. It's good enough. I accept it. But from a storytelling perspective, you would think AEW is sort of like the farm system. It's where guys go work off some ring rust. And you would think that the goal would be to take your momentum from Dark and then spurn that into something that allows you to have more success on Dynamite. You wouldn't think that you could take momentum from Dark and just turn that into a title opportunity. But I accept it. It's good enough. I'm glad they didn't brush over it like some other promotions do. It was good enough and I accepted it. And it was actually a really good match. So I'm just going to chalk it up that those guys know what they're doing a lot better than I do, which is obviously a given, because they went in there and they put on a really awesome match. There were a few screw-ups, but it was a pretty good match. And I ended up kind of coming out of it a little bigger fans of Hybrid 2 than I was going into it. And you figure that's what a match is for.
That's especially a title match. It's a showcase to put the other talent over. So I did like that they addressed it. So before the match continues, they cut backstage and we see angry Young Bucks and they're watching the match on the monitor back there. And they're not very believable heels to me, but they're doing their part. So Hybrid 2, as I said, they had some rough spots, but I was impressed with them. Jack Evans at one point did have a pretty serious botch where he went up and it looked like some sort of like corkscrew whisper in the wind type of move. That he was supposed to hit on his opponent, but he came up pretty short and he just kind of hit the ground. But he just then kind of recovered and went to the second rope and hit a moonsault. So I don't know if that was the original plan, was to do whatever he was trying to do and then hit the second rope moonsault, or if he hit the moonsault just to kind of try to cover his tracks. It was good enough. You could tell that they definitely screwed it up, but you know, that's life. When you're on live television, you gotta roll with the punches, and that's the best you can do. FTR does end up retaining. They finish the match in awkward fashion when one of the FTR guys actually hit a top rope splash. So the splash is meant to send a message to the Young Bucks, basically mocking them because they, you know, do all the flips. You remember back in their days as the Revival and WWE, their message was always fists, not flips. And so that kind of builds towards what's going to continue with them and the Young Bucks. So then it does cut backstage again, and we see the angry Young Bucks, who just happened to notice that there was a cameraman there, and they accuse him of spying on them, and they hit him with a double super kick and lay him out. It was sort of cool actually to see it from the cameraman's perspective, where the mic, excuse me, the video is on them, and then he falls back. It was kind of neat, but the acting was super cringy by the Young Bucks, and they're like, "Has he been spying on us? Should we hit him with our favorite move?" And then it sounded as awkward as it just sounded when I relayed it. So, but they hit him with the double super kick and they lay him out. And then they just kind of say like, "Oh, I guess we gotta pay another 10,000. I don't have my wallet on me." And just the idea that they would scoff. I don't know if the message is supposed to be that they have so much money now that they're in AEW that this is now their third $10,000 fine. The idea that they're just kind of laughing away a 10 grand, that's just not believable. JR on commentary kind of speculated that maybe they should be taken off TV or suspended as well. And sometimes JR can be pretty rogue on commentary. I think it's because AEW offers a lot of freedom. They don't feed in lines. We've heard so many rumors about Vince feeding his guys lines throughout the show. But they did a pretty good job at kind of explaining some alternatives, and it is good to hear the announcers say things that maybe may be off the cuff. Because again, going back to what I was talking about in the Ring of Honor Pier tournament, anything that gives it a real sports feel is always welcomed by me. So before it ends, we go back to the ring and we see that FTR is still there, kind of gathering themselves after their championship retention, and we see a graphic of two of the FTR members dressed as hot dogs. So then Best Friends music hits, and they have that same graphic across their t-shirt, and they make a small weenie, or they make a reference. They say, "Do you guys get it? You're weenies." So a small chant, a small weenie chant breaks out, and I did fully intend for the pun of small weenie. But yeah, there's a small chant there where the fans are chanting weenie, weenie, and FTR goes on and does a good job to like sell, like, "Oh, we don't like it. Don't call us weenies." So Best Friends come out and they remind FTR that they are number one contenders for the tag team championships, and they go on to reveal that they ran into Mr. Tony Khan backstage and that he told them that their tag team title match would be on the anniversary edition of Dynamite next week. So FTR does try to do a cheap shot. They try to hit him with their belts, but Best Friends duck. They tee off briefly. They get a few shots in on the champions, and then the champs are able to bail out of the ring, and they leave their belts in the ring. So Best Friends grab the belts and they pose with them, and the champs are chanting, like, give us our belts back. You're not the champs. Give us our belts back. So they do eventually give the belts back, and then they hit their spot. They did the hug, and then that cut off. So before they go to a break, we see a video package. It's MJF, and he's talking about Jericho's last 3 years. He talks about an interaction that he had with Chris Jericho a year ago on one of the first episodes of Dynamite, and he says that he and Jericho have a budding friendship that's been growing as of late. He says, Jericho, I may even come out to the ring tonight and thank you in person myself. Maybe. So that wraps it up. Before that, following that, Shaquille O'Neal is in one of the video packages congratulating Jericho on 30 years. He purposely pretends that he doesn't know what Chris Jericho's middle name is. He calls him Chris E. Jericho. And then he acts as if he's talking to someone on camera and he says, oh, I'm sorry, Chris Bartholomew Jericho, which I believe is his actual real name. There's videos from Gene Simmons, who of course is in Kiss, and then Lars Ulrich is there with a package as well. So we go to a break, and we come back from the break, and it's time for the dog collar match for, of course, the TNT title. I've been talking about this one, speculating on this one for as long as we've known about it, so I was excited to see what predictions I'd have that would happen, which ones wouldn't. They do go on to show Greg the Hammer Valentine. He's sitting in the seats. Jim Ross mentions him on commentary, and he appeared to actually have his WWE Hall of Fame ring on his hand when he was in the crowd. They obviously didn't show it, they didn't mention it, but on his left hand, if you go back and watch it, he appears to have the ring. And I don't know if I mentioned this in the past, but I met him in Reno one time when he was on a show with some guys that I used to interact with on a local level in Sacramento in terms of wrestling. And he was nice enough after the show. We met him at a diner, and he told us a bunch of great stories, and he did have his Hall of Fame ring, and he kind of showed us. And so I don't know if that's just something he wears when he goes out. He definitely earned it. I just thought that was kind of interesting. Could have just been a ring. Could have been maybe a wedding ring. Didn't look like a wedding ring. But he had some sort of ring on his hand that looked interesting to me. They talk about his 1983 dog collar match that he had with Rowdy Roddy Piper. May he rest in peace. So that's mentioned on the commentary as well. So Cody comes out in his new darker kind of entrance, the little beginning part that plays with the red lights before his actual music hits. And then he's on all black ring attire. I think his pants were actually gray, but he had a black shirt. Arn Anderson comes out with him. I believe he was also wearing a black little like sweater vest thing. And then Brandy comes out, and she's wearing all black as well. She doesn't stay out though. She kind of like accompanies him to the ring and then disappears. And then Brody Lee comes out. He's got John Silver with him. He's wearing the championship. Anna Jay is with them as well. And it was kind of interesting because John Silver had the dog collars for some reason, had the chains attached to it. And it was like, wait, so he had that backstage? Like, why would a wrestler have that? Why wouldn't like the staff have that or a referee? They didn't really. JR kind of was like, oh, they better check it out, make sure it's valid. And the ref did check it out. So I don't know really what the point of that was or if that was just an oversight. So Anna Jay does leave, and John Silver stays ringside. And then before the match, just kind of to drive home how violent this was about to be, they actually gave the ringside doctor an intro in addition to the wrestlers. And then, of course, Greg the Hammer Valentine got an intro as well. I really like, as a fan, how much build they're putting behind their second title. You know, you've got the world title. It almost has built-in hype. You do have to do a good job and build it up and hype it up. But it's good to see them putting focus on the secondary title as well, just so it doesn't seem like a worthless championship. It's super new into the company's history and into the title's history. But I really hope that they continue to do that. So as I said, Anna leaves and John Silver stays there. As the match starts, John Silver is on the apron still, and Cody and Brody kind of do a little tug of war. They're trying to get control of the chain. Eventually, Brody grabs the chain and goes to whip Cody towards the ropes. And as Cody goes, he ends up striking John Silver, I think possibly with the chain as well. And we'll touch on that. So Silver falls to the floor. He's out of frame for a second, and the action continues. And then when we see him again, he would end up rising up, and he did have a laceration. He had been busted open. So I speculate that when he collided with Cody Rhodes, he had hit him with the chain. So there was blood already right there in the match. At another point, a bit later on in the match, Cody goes to the top rope and he's trying to hit a springboard cutter, one of his signature moves. But Brody just yanks the chain and pulls him down like a pinata super hard onto the mat. Brody then goes outside and he very politely sets up a chair for John Silver and says, "Hey, I need you to sit here while, this match is going on. Stay out of the way, stay out of trouble." So then Cody comes out and Brody is able to kind of hit him with some stiff shots. And he even sends him at one point face first into the ringside area, the ring apron, which we're told is the hardest part of the ring. Cody is able to gather himself. He goes for a running drop kick. Brody Lee dodges it. And so John Silver, sitting in the chair, eats the drop kick and goes tumbling into the barricades and is incapacitated on the ground. So a little bit later, after some more action inside the ring, Anna Jay comes back out. She kind of scoops up John Silver, takes him backstage. Brody Lee's like, "Get him out of here, get him out of here." That distracts him long enough. We then later in the match realize that Cody, because he loves to bleed, so he's been busted open. And then Brody goes to the outside of the ring. Cody kind of takes the chain and yanks him and slams him into the ringside area again, and then is able to hit a really good-looking suicide dive through the center ropes. I really liked it. They do suicide dives a lot in AEW. They love cutters. They love suicide dives. But I thought, because the chain could have caused such a botch because you can't control the chain, I thought it was really good. It looked good, so I was impressed. Later on, Brody does go. He grabs the timekeeper's table, knocks all the stuff off of it, and sets it up next to the ring. He goes. He attempts to put Cody through it. Cody ends up kind of getting off the apron and slithering away because there is some distance between the two of them because the chain is fairly long. After he creates the distance, he then yanks the chain, which pulls Brody Lee off of the apron and then drops him with a cutter hard on the unforgiving floor, which looked really cool. As I said, they really love the cutter. So we saw both the signature AEW favorites, a cutter and a suicide dive. They then cut to the picture in picture, which I do kind of like that they do that, because then we get to see everything. There's no commercial breaks. But what was peculiar is during the picture in picture, they did the table spot. So Brody it gets Cody and kind of pile drives him through the table. And I'm like, why would you do the big table spot during a commercial when, even though it's picture in picture, fans are used to nothing really happening? So fans may have left. You didn't get the chance to go do the "Oh my God" thing or anything like that. The announcers are all muted, so that seemed weird. But they did it. Brody Lee would then turn out to be a member of the Bloodbath Party because he was busted open. So they do the hanging spot that I thought they would do, where Cody's hanging on the outside and he's kind of getting choked out by the chain. It was nowhere near as graphic as I thought they might do it. And that's probably how they got away with doing it on network television. But they did that spot and kind of got things going. Eventually, Cody does get into the ring. Arn Anderson tries to get involved. He takes a shot to the gut, so he's down. That pisses Cody Rhodes off. And he starts wrapping the chain around his fist and levels Brody with some chain shots, eventually hits him with the crossroads. And surprisingly, we had a new champ. I did not expect that. So that makes Cody the first guy in AEW to hold the same championship twice. We have the same we have a two-time champion now, two-time TNT. We haven't seen it with the tag titles, the women's title, or the heavyweight championship. So kind of interesting that it was the youngest championship, because that's the newest championship in AEW, but it tells the story. It does a good job. And it was good enough. I'm not going to criticize it too much. It did catch Cody a lot of grief. People are saying, already starting with the conversation about he's going to bury people and he's like Triple H and this and that. But there's always going to be that. That's the best and the worst part about the internet, is there's always going to be people complaining. So kind of fast forwarding, because we still have a lot of show to cover and not much time left. Tony Schiavone comes into the ring. He interviews the new champ, asks him, what's next. Cody says, "I want to reveal the championship next week on the anniversary show." So Orange Cassidy comes out. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't come out to his music. He just does his little thumbs up and, as if, "Hey, how about me, Cody?" Cody answers with a thumbs up of his own, and the match was set up without any communication. Excalibur then goes on to explain in a new segment, the eight-man tournament that they're going to have that is going to culminate at the pay-per-view. It's going to crown a new number one contender for the world title. So already announced, eight-man. We already know about six of the participants. So Jungle Boy, Rey Fénix, and Kenny Omega were announced the week before. And then on last Wednesday's show, we saw Wardlow, Colt Cabana, and Hangman Adam Page announced. So we're going to assume that Page and Omega are going to meet maybe in the finals. We'll see what happens there. The announcers teased it. We then go back for further tease. Alex Marvez is back there interviewing Kenny Omega. And Kenny says he's back full-time as a single star. He talks up his success in tournaments elsewhere around the world. Says that he's won a lot of them. He throws shade at Adam Hangman Page. Calls him a tag team wrestler on two different occasions. His lines, he kind of stumbled over them. And I was really wondering in some of those backstage segments when they have the opportunity to maybe edit them, maybe they should. I stumble over my words on this podcast, so I know how awkward it can be, but I thought maybe it would be a more natural thing. So next match was Serena Deeb taking on Big Swole. It was a good match. Big Swole would pick up the victory, but it was a really good match. It was very technically wrestled. I really liked it. Swole hits a headbutt that looked really awesome, and then eventually towards the finish of the match, she hits a second headbutt followed by an elbow, and that gave her the win. They then show a super, super, super great video package featuring Jon Moxley, and he's talking about how everybody's trying to pull the trigger on him and take his championship, and that the last time he hands his belt over to the timekeeper could be the last time he ever sees it. He puts over Lance Archer, says Archer might be the guy who can do it, talks about their occasions in Japan, says Japan, doesn't mention New Japan specifically, but it was really cool because it was the second time, in addition to the Tanahashi sighting earlier, that we actually saw New Japan reference. During Tanahashi's speech, he actually had the New Japan logo behind him, so that was really cool. So it showed how good the AEW videos can be. That's why I think they should utilize them more. So they spotlight next week, the TNT title, the tag titles, and the world title are all going to be on the line on the anniversary show. Miro and Kip Sabian are also going to be in action, but there were no opponents revealed for those guys. So the last match is the main event. It's Chris Jericho and Hager versus Chaos Theory, which is Luther and then his little buddy as well, Serpentico, is that his name? So Jericho comes out. There was a little video package, one final video package featuring Lance Storm. Kevin Smith, the comedy legend, was in there from Clerks, Infamy. Gabriel Iglesias and Chavo Guerrero hit a little thank you for him as well. And even Ultimo Dragon had some nice words. That was a face I hadn't seen in wrestling for a while. I'm not really into Luther. I don't know if it's just me. I know he's got a lot of history. They tried to tie some of the 90s history into it as well. And I was kind of trying to give Luther the benefit of the doubt. He hit a really good front somersault off the top rope onto all the Inner Circle members. It was the same move that we saw Brandy hit on the Dark Order last week. But he tried to go around the ring post at one point and he slipped. He tried to do a bulldog from the top rope, which was super botchtastic. And I know he's an older dude, and they wanted to tie up the story with him and Jericho from the 90s, but I don't know. I know, obviously, to stick in wrestling this long, you have to be pretty good, so I'm not going to shit on the guy. He's obviously a lot more athletic than me, but it wasn't great. So to kind of finish off the match, Jericho does grab Floyd, attempts to use Floyd. Aubrey Edwards was distracted by outside action, so Luther gets Floyd, and Floyd is the baseball bat, of course, and hits Jericho with it. And that gets him a two count. It seemed like that was going to end it. So Jericho does eventually catch him with the Judas effect in the match. Jericho gets on the mic. He thanks the fans, starts to talk. MJF's music hits. It cuts him off. He comes out with two presents, one of which turns out to be a clown that is called Clownico Le Clown. And then he has a second gift, which is a framed picture of MJF. Jericho takes the picture, breaks it over the clown's head, and says that he hates clowns and he doesn't want to ever be interrupted ever again. And it's real stern and it seems like there's something going on. But then he ends up laughing, and so it seems like it's just a tease. MJF says he has a career-defining announcement that he's going to do next week on Dynamite on the anniversary show, and he wants Jericho present for that. So we will see what that is.
But guys, we just had another great show. If you sat with me through the full hour and you enjoyed it, I want to thank you. If you sat here and you didn't enjoy it, I want to thank you anyways for getting through it. But this has been a tremendous honor. I will get the NXT episode up soon. I'm going to go home. I'm going to watch SmackDown. And I'm going to bring all that action to you guys. Again, thank you so, so much for listening and sharing and hyping the show up and everything you guys do. But that's all for now. I'm tapping out.